So tonight, this being the fourth week of this course, we're going to take a shift in a sense. So the first 3 weeks we were talking about the first foundation, what's called the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of body. And before I go on, I want to mention the reason that comes first is once we can tune into body sensation and the subtleties of it and tune into how it shifts. Often later on when we're looking at particular mental factors, being able to tune into the body can often help us see what mental factors are actually there. They're, because mind and body are of course intimately connected. And so we start with body and we practice with body because it leads us to being able to be more skillful looking at other things. And then we come today to the second foundation of mindfulness, and this is called Vedana. Vedana is a Pali word. You see it often translated in things as feelings. The problem with that is that's in English, that's a word that has multiple meanings. Feelings like, you know, am I happy, am I sad, all those sorts of feelings, right? Emotions. Whereas here, the Vedana is referring very precisely to something else, which is called, and we often translate it to be precise as feeling tone. Maybe it could be called feeling vibe or something. I don't know. Feeling tone is the traditional one that I've heard more often than anything else. And feeling tone is a very precise mental factor. So now we've moved from away from body into mind that has a very simple process involved. And it goes something like this. Something arises at one of the six sense doors. So at some level of body or mental, we tune into something or something arises in our consciousness. Immediately after that happens, Vedana, feeling tone, arises. And Vedana has only three flavors, three modes. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. And you often see it's like neither pleasant nor unpleasant, right? But I like neutral because it's sort of more precise in a way and less wordy. And then, based on that feeling tone, we start to react. But that's it. It's this really simple thing that just arises. Anytime something arises in consciousness that we notice. The thing about it is, it's very fleeting. It happens very quickly. And often we sort of conflate the feeling tone with the experience. We make it one thing. So I had a piece of chocolate cake for dessert tonight. It's really good. And I could very easily go, oh, chocolate cake is always pleasant. But if I had the flu and someone offered me a piece of chocolate cake, it'd be like, maybe neutral, maybe even unpleasant. It'd be hard to get it to be unpleasant, but it would certainly be neutral. Like, nah, I don't think I want to eat chocolate cake right now. So the Vedana, the mental arising of Vedana, is separate from the object, and the form that Vedana takes varies based on causes and conditions that preceded that moment of arising. So they're separate things. The problem is that it is because it's so fleeting, it's sometimes hard to notice. And so part of what we want to do is learn to actually start to note Vedana itself. Can we actually see Vedana arising in that brief moment? It's also if something arises and is there for a while, and we notice it three or four times, we might note that even in that short period of time, the Vedana changes. Like, something, some sound arises, and it seems kind of pleasant, and we so pleasant Vedana arises. But then it's there for a while, it's just sort of droning on and droning on, and it might turn into neutral, and it might even turn to quite strong. Oh God, why won't that sound stop? Now it's unpleasant. Same sound. So noting Vedana of something that's there for a while is a way for us to see impermanence, because the Vedana itself is an impermanent mental arising. It arises and then it's gone, and it keeps changing. Finally, there's two other things I want to mention before I get into the next section of this. And that is in the refrain, which we talked about last week. Remember, the Buddha says it can be something can rise externally or it can rise internally. And in some of the commentaries, you see very distinct messages about external Vedana. It's sort of like, well, you got to be careful because that can lead to clinging. That chocolate cake was really great. Boy, I want more. Or maybe we should make another chocolate cake tomorrow, or whatever. We get caught up in that pretty easily. So we end up in clinging to the object that was associated with that Vedana. Whereas internal is like that sort of feeling you get, that energy you get when something arises or something's happening, like calm. You notice that calm is present. And then you know the Vedana, which is pleasant. As long as you're not trying to reproduce that experience over, oh, I wanted that calm to come back again because it was so pleasant. The pleasantness itself is quite wholesome, and it's what often encourages us to keep practicing. And because we understand that, as I work with my practice, and from time to time calm arises, this pleasant vibe comes with it. And that in and of itself sometimes encourages us to practice. We also, by the way, I also, it's sort of an arbitrary divide, internal, external. So also external could be something like you're sitting on the high up on, above the tree line, the side of a mountain, and the sun is shining on the forest below you or a lake, and you're just sitting there and you're just like, it's an external stimulus, but it's so beautiful that you can sort of think of that as an okay external pleasant feeling. It doesn't get in the way. The pleasantness is just because of the situation you're in that you've maybe even put some effort, took a bit of effort to get up there to the side of that mountain to look down and see that beautiful view. So this it's an interesting place you have to watch a little bit, that you don't get addicted to the pleasant feeling, that you don't try and reproduce it over and over again, that it just the feeling tone has to just be there because of causes and conditions that just occurred. But there's a much more important thing about Vedana that I haven't talked about yet. And that's that there's this teaching that's actually unique to the Buddha. It's called codependent arising. It sounds very technical. First of all, what the heck is codependent arising? I think we have to answer that question. And basically, what it says is if B arises. A must have preceded it. And not only that, it works both ways. So if A arises, B will arise. So it's a bidirectional codependent connection between one thing arising, then that next thing will arise. And there's traditionally taught 12 steps in codependent arising. Some of them are verge on the philosophical. I want to sort of start partway through this list. And basically, it's about number three says, causes are and conditions are such that something arises. Whatever that something is, right? Something that we're going to sense in some way. And then consciousness arises if that sensory experience is actually noticed, which means you have a functioning sense organ and you have attention, another factor. Of another mental factor applied to that sense organ, then consciousness of that experience arises. So I'll give you a personal example of what I mean. When I was a kid, this is way before, we didn't even have television. That's how far back this goes. And I was a big reader. We were living in Europe on an Air Force base, a Canadian Air Force base, and this TV didn't exist. This is in the 50s. So I read all the time. And my mother, would be making dinner and she'd say, "Barry, dinner's ready." And I'd be sitting there in the chair in the living room with my face in this book. And it was like I was ignoring her. And she'd sort of get upset and she'd say it a bit louder. And sometimes she'd have to say it three or four times before I would sort of, "Oh, yeah, dinner." Also, an important thing is almost important as books. But it wasn't that I was ignoring her. It's like my attention was so focused on the book and what I was reading and what I was imagining from what I was reading that even though the sound bounced off my ear, my attention just wasn't there. And this is part of how senses work. We have to have a functioning sense organ, but we also have to have mental attention attached to that sense organ at the moment of something arising. But if given that, then consciousness of that arising is there. And then immediately following that, I mean, immediately, like split second later, Vedana arises, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So that's the next. That's the third step. Causes and conditions, consciousness based on me paying attention, and then Vedana itself, the mental factor of Vedana arises. And then what normally happens is this. Depending on the Vedana, one of three habitual mental patterns arise. If it's pleasant, then we grasp that object. We want to keep it. We want more of it. If it's unpleasant, aversion arises. We want to push it away. And if neither pleasant nor unpleasant is there, and we're noticing it, and it's just sort of neutral, like, who cares? Often what happens is delusion. We start manufacturing things to make it pleasant, or start manufacturing things mentally to create a stronger sensation than what we're getting from that sense object that we just perceived, because it's so boring, neutral, blah, and the mind runs off and tries to create something. in all of those three habitual patterns, but particularly in craving, wanting, grasping, or aversion, pushing away, what arises next is called clinging. Clinging is this process where not only do we experience the thing, not only does the vedana, pleasant vedana arise, not only does that wanting it more arise, but then we like really glom onto it. Like, okay, yeah. Not only am I do I want it, I'm in the and figuring out how to get some more chocolate cake process right away. I don't want to bake one, but I can just go to that store. I know they have great chocolate cake, blah, blah, blah. The mind's really holding on to it tightly now. And the interesting thing is, even when it's unpleasant and we're trying to push it away, we still cling. Because to push something away, first of all, you got to get a really good hold of it. If I want to fling something, I got to grip it solidly before I can fling it. So whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and we're caught in the grasping or aversion process, we cling in both cases. And then once we've clung to it, we start to make that object mine. That's my chocolate cake. And I want more. We start creating a sense of a separate self based on that clinging energy. And so a sense of self, of separate self, arises. And this is how we continually, moment to moment, keep creating a sense of a separate self. Because we just react to the Vedana unconsciously. We don't even notice the Vedana. We're just like we're off to the races right away. And there we are clinging and making things mine or not mine, or that's not mine, don't want that. But still sense of self is there. So this is the classic way where we repeatedly, over and over and over again, create a sense of a separate self. And then out of that sense of a separate self, of course, suffering arises. And suffering leads to a return to the cycle and more causes, and which creates more causes and conditions, which here we go around and around. The good news, this so it sounds like all bad news so far. The good news is that if we can actually note the Vedana itself, we can actually see Vedana arise and note it clearly. Then at that point, we have a chance. When I say a chance to go, oh, I don't have to grasp it or try and push it away. I can just note it. I can just see the Vedana. So Vedana is like the exit from the process of constantly recreating a sense of self. I can just note the Vedana, see the pleasantness or unpleasantness, and not cling. Just go, oh, pleasant. Oh, unpleasant. Oh, neutral, neutral. Most things are neutral. And this is why the Buddha spent so much time. This is why this simple mental formation, Vedana, is the entire second foundation to mindfulness. The Buddha separates this out from everything else that you could possibly experience because it's so important. That right at this, because at that moment when Vedana is there, if you see it, then you can choose not to follow your habitual reactive patterns. Which is a good idea because it means that we now are not, we're not reactive, we're not creating more suffering, we're just being aware of what's arising in the moment. literally in the moment. Because something arises, and then Vedana always arises. It's guaranteed it's going to be there. This is one of the great discoveries of the Buddha, that he looked at his mind so precisely and saw this, and then Vedana, not, so it appears, as the second foundation of mindfulness. It appears in this teaching on the 12 stages of codependent arising. It also appears in another thing we'll talk about in like 4 weeks or so. And so it's a really important, subtle thing that if we can start to tune into it, it starts to really change what's happening in our mind as we practice. Now, having said all that, I have to be very careful here. It's very easy, having just heard me rant for the last 20 minutes or so about how important this is, for you to go, "Oh, if I can't see Vedana, that's it, I'm finished." Believe me, don't think that even for 1 second. Because at some level you're noticing it all the time anyway, but you're so caught in it and so reactive to it that you don't have the crispness of mind to go, "Oh, but I don't have to react to that." And that's where the practice is. That's where the wisdom of practice is, where you start to have these little moments throughout your practice session. And maybe it's like 3 or 4 times in a half hour practice. You'll not only note the, see the Vedana, experience the Vedana, but you'll note it clearly, and then you can choose not to react. And over time, that occurs more often. So don't make yourself crazy thinking, "Oh, I got to see every moment of Vedana." Well, you have 20 sense experiences a second, so that means you got to see 20 arisings of Vedana. Well, probably not going to do that. Don't even try. No. So it's a matter of as your practice goes along, and you get to those places in your practice where your mind is sort of calming and getting a little stiller and a little more focused, that's when you'll also have the space to notice the Vedana. Because as the mind gets stiller and calmer, the mind sort of slows down, is the only words I can think of. Things start to slow down a little bit. And whether things are actually slowing down or our ability to tune into them is speeding up, I don't know. Who cares which one of those it's true? But it's like there will be times in the practice, any time you practice, where there'll be these moments of crispness where you can tune into Vedana more clearly. And then if you start to note it, then that'll be even more precise over time. So that's the practice for today. The idea is we're going to practice just like we have for the last 3 weeks. We're going to just sit and note the breath. We're going to note, expand out and note anything arising at any of the sense doors. And then over time, as we sort of get tuned in and sort of keep that noting flowing for more than one breath or 2 breaths, and then gradually you get more and more precision and you start to note more steadily, the mind just naturally goes calm and Vedana sort of almost by itself becomes clear. Because you'll Now that you know what it is, now that you know what you're looking for, essentially, it'll become obvious. Oh, that thing he was yakking about. And that's good practice. That's all you need to do. Just notice that. And that's plenty to do today. So at this point, I'm going to stop talking. I will, in a few seconds, turn off the record function. So people who are listening to the recording, you know this is the time for you to do some practice and then turn the recording back on, because they'll have a few more things to say afterwards, though probably not a lot tonight. So let's just settle into our practice seat, however you see that, whether you're sitting, whether you're sitting in the chair, whether you're sitting on a cushion, whether you're lying down. You can practice lying down. If it's one of those days where your back is sore or something, just lie down. You can practice lying down. I mean, when we're talking about mindfulness of body, the Buddha said practice walking, standing, seated, lying down. Also, if you're getting sleepy, stand up and practice standing up. Also a perfectly valid way to practice. And we think sitting is like, oh, we're supposed to sit. Well, that's one of four things the Buddha mentions. So feel free to adjust your practice to what's actually going on in your body right now. And then let's just sit for 30 minutes and see what arises.
You're still muted, Barry.
So I really don't have anything more to say about this particular topic. It's very much, you sort of feel your way into it over time, and you learn to start to see Vedana more frequently, tune into it, and then start to skillfully shift your reactive patterns of mind. So what I'd like to do, as I always do at this point, is sort of turn this over to you folks, see if there are any questions, any comments, anything you'd like to share about what happened as you sat there for the last half hour. How was it when did you become obsessed by trying to see Vedana, for instance, which is often what happens when I give this talk. So just tell me, how are things going out there in general? Just turn on your mic and start. Oh, go ahead, Natalie.
Oh, hi. At risk of this being more of a tangent than an answer to your question, I really liked that you talked at the end right before we practiced about sort of adapting. Am I going to sit today? Am I going to walk today? Am I going to stand today? To how you're feeling in your body. And it had me kind of thinking about how in some ways the goal is to notice the feelings, and, I guess the goal is to mindfully choose to do something with it or notice it. There's a balance, I think, to be had there. I suppose I'm not quite sure how to ask this question. I noticed, in my practice today, a sort of feeling of restlessness, and in part, I think that's because I find that this topic, though it can be very, I don't know, it's I don't want to say that it's simple at the outset, but it's helpful to describe it in simple terms. But you can very, at least in my experience, I can go down a rabbit hole with the whole idea and the ins and outs of it. And I found myself at times during the practice trying to sort of, in some ways, figure out how to forgive myself in ways for noticing that I've reactively acted, or in some ways noticing that I've noted the impulse or the vedana, if I'm using the term properly in that respect. And then, and then sort of choosing to give into the impulse in some ways. I think it was a bit of a gray area there in my experience of that. With that restlessness, and this is, I promise this is related. I tend to fidget while seated. So, at times, for example, if I'm not in a space to do like walking meditation or somewhere where I can move around a lot, what are your thoughts on sort of mindful movement while seated? Or I'll turn my camera on for just a moment. I ended up kind of grabbing one of these little marble fidgets and was just trying to like mindfully move it at the end of the practice because I found it difficult to sit with that restlessness. And in some ways I'm probably overconceiving of it to be sort of a reaction to maybe not boredom, but in a way it's like, am I embellishing my experience by using this tool, or is this a tool to sort of meet where I'm at today? I know it's a very convoluted set of multiple questions, but what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so yeah, there are multiple questions there for sure.
Yes.
First of all, the fact that you noted the restlessness, because restlessness is just a mental formation that arises. We're going to talk more about that in a couple of weeks. But the fact that you noted it, it's very skillful in and of itself that you saw that. So that's two thumbs up. The tricky part about doing things, fidgeting, whatever, is that there is a very direct relationship between stillness of body and stillness of mind. And so, over time, when that restlessness arises, you over time will learn to go, oh, my old friend restlessness is here again, but I don't actually have to move. I don't need to get my fidget toy. I can just sit still. And that's practice, and that takes time. But the longer you can sit still, the more quiet and calm and focused your mind becomes. Having said that, at times, I mean, you have a space, you're in there. You could, if you're restless, sometimes when restlessness is really strong, it's actually quite skillful to get up and do walking practice instead. And actually walk mindfully back and forth, like just a little short path, because you don't have a big giant room there, but like back and forth, 5 paces, turn around, walk back and forth, and see if that is a way to work with the restlessness and still be mindful. So you can, I'm not sure with the fidget toy because that's just too easy in a way. But if you could, it's okay to like stand up. Okay, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to do walking practice instead. It's one of the four modes of practice that the Buddha suggests. So that might be a way to work skillfully with restlessness. And then, if the walking practice leads to the mind getting a little stiller, the restlessness goes away, then sit back down. See what happens. And over time, you'll learn to be more still. Hopefully that answers most of your question.
Yeah, that answered a lot of it. Yeah. So just to clarify, like the walking practice is like, I could see how, the breath or walking, or in a way it's you're doing something with intention, and it's a point of focus. And I think in some ways that can translate to other activities, but it sounds like at least with the teachings of the Buddha in general, like walking is absolutely more preferable to, you know, moving a marble back and forth, even if I'm trying to do it with tension. Okay.
And when you're walking, you would, instead of noting the breath, you would note the stepping itself. You note this, that the predominant, the anchor of the practice is the sensations in your feet,
Yeah.
and that would
Okay.
be what you pay more attention to. So you've also sort of shifted your primary meditation object when you stand up and start walking.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to make sure I'm kind of conceiving of this properly as well. In a sense, the walking, it's a movement, it's something you're doing consciously, but because it's something that, you know, humans are sort of programmed to, like, there is a neural mechanism that is sort of automatic in the process of walking. You don't have to think about it too hard. Does that help with the sense of, like, noting and being that we're trying to cultivate in some ways with the practice? Is that part of the reason why this is, it's sort of like a preferable point of focus or action, if that makes sense?
I'm saying it's preferable only because it's one of the antidotes to restlessness that is traditionally taught, is walking
Okay.
practice. And the idea is that it's still quite prescribed. Like, you're walking 5 paces, you're turning around, and you're walking back again. Or in a small room, you might walk in a very slow circle, but stay going this, so you're not sort of wandering all over the room. You're choosing a path and sticking with it, either walking back and forth or you're walking in a small circle.
Okay.
So there's a simplicity to it, like sitting is simple.
Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you going into that
Oh,
with
that's what I do. I'm happy to do it. Okay, Kevin, you've had your mic on for a while.
I accidentally, but it made me think of like in some traditions I've seen people using mala beads or something like that. You know, like just kind of like passing them hand to hand as they're sitting and meditating. That
Yeah,
was one thing. And
mala has to do more, because I at one time way back when, before I came to this form of practice, I had a mala and I wore it all the time, and I was practicing with it all the time.
yeah.
And but the mala was a way of, like you'd say, I'm going to do 5 malas of practice, and you'd be saying a mantra, and every time you said the mantra, you'd count a bead. 108 beads on the mala, that would mean you'd say your mantra. If you did 5 malas, you'd do 108 times, whatever, 540 repetitions. And it was a way of keeping track of your practice.
Yeah.
I suppose it had some concentrative aspect to it. I never thought of it that way, but it's sort of, because it's something very simple. You know, you're sitting still, but and the only thing that's moving is your hand. Actually, a couple of fingers and a thumb.
And again, on the it took me years to just like completely still. Till like, you know, I don't know if now and for quite some time, it's just that was kind of like the first step. But it took a long time to get to that first step.
It's like sitting still is a conscious practice. When I was really starting to work on it, I'd actually, form the intention in my mind. Okay, now I'm going to be still for the next X, whatever the length of that practice was going to be. And then when that urge to move, to scratch my nose or to wiggle or whatever would arise, I'd have that intention sort of in the back of my mind going, you don't need to do that. And I'd sit stiller. And over time, as I went deeper into practice, I could sit still for like an hour and a half. But that was a lot of practice. I don't think I have to do that right away, but I learned to be able to sit still for very long periods of time. And over that time, I could also see the direct, that straight line relationship of the mind going stiller the more my body stayed still. Other questions, comments, thoughts? Go ahead, Jeff.
I'd say that in the course of trying to watch for the Vedana, I don't know that I ever saw the Vedana itself, but just the process of looking for it and trying to notice it, I felt a lot less reactive to the, especially like the negative feelings that were arising. Like when I would notice, oh yeah, that's a negative thought. Like did I see where my mind decided to take the, unpleasant course, when did that valence arrive? And it was just easier to, I think, sort through the thoughts as they are, as they arise. Yeah.
And that means that even if you're being reactive for much shorter periods of time.
Right. Yeah.
And that's partly because because you set the intention to see Vedana, that in and of itself is a concentrative process. So that has part of I think, why that worked the way it did for you.
Yeah, I
Because you
think so
set,
too.
intention is a very powerful thing. If we can, we can set intention to, see Vedana and see what happens. We can set intention to be still. We can set intention to do all kinds of different things. And setting intention is a, I mean, it is the second step on the Eightfold Path. I mean, there might be a reason it's there.
Fair. Yeah, that's fair.
That's it can be very helpful in practice by forming clear intention. In that practice, one practice session mode, and in the broader sense of intention to keep practicing no matter what, Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Other questions, comments, thoughts? Oh, Jonna, go ahead.
I just want to external things coming in like a sound, it was easier for me to pick up on Vedana. I mean, I would kind of hear it and think, unpleasant, unpleasant. But then I would get lost in thought and I was thinking, it's harder to notice the Vedana in your thoughts. Like your thoughts are almost like a train. They're just like off before you know it. And so I'd have to like backtrack and go back with it. I don't know.
Welcome to the real world of mind. it's much easier for physical sensation to notice Vedana than for mental stuff. We're often, but even then, if you're on the train, which is just a series of moments, and then in the moment you go, oh, and the moment that you notice your thinking, you remember what's going on, at that moment, Vedana has also arisen. Can you see that Vedana? Just that momentary Vedana, that moment of waking up. That might be in and of itself, oh, there's a moment of Vedana.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? So we had enough.
I found it easier to note the unpleasant sensations, whether they be physical or mental, than the pleasant. And I really didn't even think about the neutral.
Yeah, well, neutral's neutral. Like, who cares? I mean, they just go by. The thing I would be when you say it was much easier for you to see the unpleasant than the pleasant is we have to be careful that we don't turn this practice into just seeing all the unpleasant things. That we have to also tune into that moment when the mind was calm and notice the presentness of that calmness, because that encourages us to practice. So just be aware that if that's your tendency, set the intention to, I'm going to try and notice at least a couple of things that were pleasant. And not just get caught in seeing all the unpleasant stuff. Because that's just pretty depressing after a while.
Yeah. I did notice some pleasant, but
Yeah, and that's also our nature and character. Some people tend more that way, some people more tend the other way. And that's just who we are. Like our history of life and our nature. There's even in Buddhist psychology, there's this whole thing about three different kinds of people. People who are tend towards wanting, grasping, clinging people. People who are more aversive people, and people who are sort of more delusional people. And there's long, long stories and things about, well, if you're a grasping person, this is how you should practice. And this is all from the Abhidhamma. I don't know much about it, but I remember one of my teachers was really big on this, and we always give a Dharma talk on these three different kinds of personalities. And part of it is we just have certain personalities that are attracted to noticing certain things. We're human beings, what a surprise.
Yeah, part of it I think is that I had a social get together with a group of men today. So when I do something like that, I tend to, and it wasn't necessarily pleasant. It wasn't all pleasant. So I tend to replay things that were said and things that I said, that sort of thing. So
Things I wish I'd said, but I didn't say. Yeah.
I'm that kind of in that mode.
And that's also true. We've been like, what were the causes and conditions when we sat down to meditate? What came before? Did I have this wonderful piece of chocolate cake and I'm sitting here smiling with my chocolate smile? Or did I have a discussion that was sometimes difficult? Those are the causes and conditions that brought to the moment when I sat down. And that's going to affect your mind too. It's all okay. I've been neglecting to read poetry at the end of these things. I want to share. This is just, I like this poem because it's, has a, makes me feel happy with this poem. What can I say? This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence, and it's called I Am Standing. I am standing on the dunes in the heat of summer, and I am listening to Mockingbird again, who is tonguing his embellishments, and in the distance, the shy, weed-loving sparrow, who has but one soft song, which she sings again and again. And something somewhere inside my own unmusical self begins humming. Thanks for the beauty of the world. Thanks for my life. To be a good way to start every day. Dedicate the merit of a practice. May the beneficial energy arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.